Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tripcast. I'm Representative Aaron Pena, and I'm proud to introduce a group of people that are on everyone's worst list. Here's your Tripcast crew.
Thank you, Representative Pena. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Texas Tribune Tripcast for the third week of June. None of the regular cast is here today, but instead we've upgraded to reporter Julian Aguilar.
Hello.
Morgan Smith of the Texas Tribune. Hello.
Hello.
And Jim Henson of University of Texas and the Texas Tribune University of Texas poll.
Hi, Reeve.
Hello. How are you? Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, it's a joy. This is your third time?
It is.
Okay. Well, unlike the other times, this time we'll be talking about the much-awaited Texas Monthly Best and Worst List. We'll talk about the special session, specifically education and immigration. And then we might as well touch on whether or not the Texas governor is running for president, because it's all anyone can focus on. But maybe, Jim, you have the best and worst lists with you. If you could do a sort of dramatic reading.
Sure. The best on the best list, it was Branch, Duncan, Guerin, Hartnett, Keffer, Ogden, Villarreal, Whitmire, Saporini, and Zerwas, right? I think I just hand-wrote that in. The worst, which is really a lot more fun and a much tougher pick because there's so many more to choose from, Berman, Bonin, Christian, Dewhurst, which raised a lot of eyebrows, Fraser, Nelson, Phillips, Solomons, Wentworth, and Zedler.
And nowhere on that list is Wendy Davis.
Nowhere on that list is Wendy Davis. We haven't seen the article yet. I can't help but think that there's going to be some kind of a sidebar on the new face of the Democratic Party.
Right. Of course, Wendy Davis is the one that filibustered her way into the special session and everybody else's way into the special session. A lot of people thought she might be on either list.
Right, she was on both of the highly derivative Texas Tribune Inside Intelligence list. I want to thank Paul Burka for allowing us to sort of promote the 10 best and 10 worst through the Inside Intelligence poll.
Yes.
Thanks, Paul.
I think he will appreciate your thanks very much. Were you guys surprised or not surprised by anyone on the list? Was anything particularly deserved? I will say that I was a little bit surprised that it was just Dewhurst as far as the leadership goes, and I think that particularly stings if you're only just the lieutenant governor is on the worst. The speaker's nowhere to be found. The governor's nowhere to be found. I had heard that there would likely be a sort of there is no leadership type comment in the list, but at least right now, until we actually see the article, it looks like Dewhurst has all the baggage on his shoulders.
Well, I was surprised that in a session where public education issues have been so important and have kind of have dominated the discourse, that we didn't see education leaders from either chamber on either of the lists, the best or worst, you know, depending on what your perspective was on the proposals that came from Shapiro and Hochberg in the House. And then you didn't really see any type of school finance proposal from Rob Eisler until the very end. So I thought that was an interesting exclusion there.
You've been watching it, Morgan. Do you think Eisler dodged a bullet?
I think so. I mean, he's...
Well, a normal bullet or like a golden bullet of bestness?
No, I meant a dark bullet of worstness.
He definitely wasn't going to get Rookie of the Year.
Right. I mean, leading into the session, he talked a lot about how he was going to come up with a school finance plan, that the budget reductions were going to be this great opportunity to reform our school funding, and nothing came out. He proposed nothing in committee, and then basically at the last minute he came up with this kind of very simple across-the-board cut plan that became the approach from the House.
I've got a pen where you want to just write him on there.
You said Dewhurst raised some eyebrows. Why were you surprised that he made the worst list? How much of it had to do with the fact that the regular session Sanctuary Cities bill, that he didn't go around the two-thirds and just kind of let it die in the upper chamber?
Well, I mean, I wasn't surprised. I was only surprised in the way that, you know, there's an elephant in the room and people often ignore it. I mean, I think there's a lot of subterranean complaining, frankly, about the lieutenant governor that doesn't make it into print very much and isn't articulated, you know, very publicly. And so I think you could hear almost an audible, on Twitter as Dewhurst's name popped up. You know, so yeah, so it's not so much that I think about his dessert, but I think people are reluctant sometimes to pick on him. I mean, going back to the way you initially did this, talking about the leadership, I think the interesting thing is if you look kind of underneath this, Strauss not only is not on the list, but three of his lieutenants are on the best list. I mean, you know, Branch, Guerin, and Keffer are Strauss's deacons, and they all made the best list. And I think that actually, you know, says something.
Right. Speaking of Branch, I should note that both higher education chairman, the chair and the chairwoman from the Senate made the best list, Zaffirini and Branch. I mean, it was actually a pretty good session for higher education. This also might get into, they have this whole other side issues going on with higher education, and Branch and Zaffirini have both sort of taken leadership roles in that. It'll be interesting to see what factor that played in their selection, as opposed to the fact that they both just happened to pass a lot of higher ed bills.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's this thing about passing a lot of bills, that there's also a kind of, I mean, if you, to me, looking at this list, it's a very kind of institutionally oriented list. I mean, if you look at this, it's guys that are, you know, the best list are people that are brokers, people that were able to get things passed, but not, you know, driven by their own agenda too much. If you look at the worst list, it's guys with egos, it's ideologues, you know, for the most part.
I was surprised that Berman was on there. What has Berman done this session that's different from anything he's ever done?
He's caused such a divide between the extremists and the moderates and the people on the other side, and he's caused a lot of people to really be upset at some of the language that he's put out there, that he personally has put out there with some of the bills and some of the comments that he's made. In my opinion, I think that's what it is. And you know, Burka said when Ross interviewed him a while back, he's like, it's not about politics, it's people that get in the way or people that cause this sort of divide. And I think that Representative Berman accomplished a lot of that, even within his own party, beginning with him bashing Strauss and you know, that letter that circulated that from Bert Solomon saying, you know, you are a liar. Everybody remembers how he started that off. And I think
Bert Solomon, who's also on the worst list.
Who's also on the worst list, which actually I was kind of surprised, because he did get HB 12 through the House, which it wasn't too difficult because of their numbers. So, I mean, does anybody want to weigh in on why he might have made the worst? Is it the redistricting thing? Is it, I mean, anybody out there? Hello?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is redistricting. I think part of it is that he's also, I think, widely perceived as difficult. I mean, I think if you look at the way he conducted his hearings, he was often kind of surly and impatient. And I think that's the kind of thing that, you know, and again, this is, we should notice, this is the first year that Patty hasn't done it. So this is a little bit of a change in terms of the inside process of the list.
Also, the first year that they've used Twitter to roll it out.
Right. So it'll be interesting to kind of see when they actually discuss it, what the internal politics of this were like. But I think that, you know, that's another one of those things where there's a real bias in this, and by bias I don't mean that negative, but just the bias is towards being agreeable, working with your colleagues, having a sense of, you know, the chamber and the will of the body. And I think Solomon's doesn't always convey that.
Do we think that the reason Wendy Davis didn't make an appearance anywhere is that we haven't seen the results of the special session that she brought us into?
Well, that's a good question, and that is also a good transition point to get into your area of expertise. I don't know if that's a coincidence that you made the comment.
Last one, Morgan.
But, I mean, her stand that she took at the end of the regular session was about education.
Right.
How has it been for education? Has it been a disaster? Have they got anything particularly worse, particularly better than they would have gotten had she just, you know, stayed quiet at the end of the regular session and let that bill pass?
Well, it depends on what your perspective is, because we have seen several education bills that died during the regular session that look like they are going to pass during the special session. That is, in particular, the mandate relief bills that ease restrictions for districts looking to lay off teachers. They changed the minimum salary schedule for teachers, and even a very, very watered down version of the class size bill, which essentially just gives the Commissioner of Education a broader authority to grant waivers to districts to meet the requirement. But those are all things that died during the special session. And then the other significant change, a bill that's getting through, is a charter school bill, which charter school advocates have tried for years and years to get passed, and that is granting charter schools access to the permanent school fund for facilities bond backing. I think on the mandate relief side for school administrators, school boards, they're all happy that stuff is getting passed. Teachers groups are not. And for the charter school stuff, that's probably something that's not pleasing school administrators either. And as far as the actual funding plan, it's basically the same thing, though, you know, there's a possibility that this amendment from Donna Howard that would dedicate any excess growth in the rainy day fund to school funding could get through. But, you know, we saw 17 Republicans in the House vote for it. That's still well short of the 2/3 it would need to get in both chambers when it comes back from conference committee.
What do you think the repercussions of the budget to public ed is going to have at the next election? I mean, a lot of these districts, these large districts, are from these areas that elect a lot of these conservative leaders. Do you think that's going to come back to their detriment in November?
Well, I mean, I think the one thing the session has done is brought public education to the forefront of everybody's mind. And so it's something that voters are paying attention to. Whether or not they're going to remember that, you know, months from now, we'll have to see. And of course, it's going to take, you know, we're going to go through this next school year, and that's when people are really going to start to see the effects of the budget cuts.
What do you think? I mean, these are teachers. These are the people. These are the middle class. These are the people that teach their students about the process and, you know, civics classes and go out and vote. And this is who represents you. This is how important it is. I mean, are they going to walk the walk and say, hey, you know what I mean? I preach it. I'm going to go back and take care of it.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is are these people voting for Republicans in the first place? Yeah. I don't know.
Well, the teachers don't. I mean, I think there's a couple of things about this. I mean, I think, you know, first there's always been the question of what is the lag, right? So we went in knowing they were going to cut public education in all likelihood, and wondering, okay, so do people begin to really notice? And I think it's not so much the teachers as it is the parents that you know. Sure, the teachers are probably by and large not voting Republican already. It's really how are the parents going to perceive this? And there's another piece here, which is that not just the cuts to schools, but also the fact that districts are already beginning to talk about raising property taxes. And that, I think, is the long-term problem here that people begin to notice. I mean, that maybe is a little too cynical, but I think it's one thing for people to see their schools cutting back. Some parents will be bothered by that. I think that's an open question. But as property taxes go up to pay for this? I mean, I think another thing I would note about this, though, and I in a way of slightly disagreeing with Morgan, I wonder...
Be careful.
Yeah, I know. She's
only slightly.
She's got this open pen right here. But you know, I mean, there's a narrative out there that says that Wendy Davis kind of opened all this up in a special session. And I'm not sure that's exactly true, and I think that may be why she's not on this list. That is, I think we had a high likelihood that there was going to be another special session anyway.
Well, not a high likelihood.
The governor had already said, right?
We were assured.
And so, you know, the fact that sort of Wendy Davis is solely responsible for opening all these issues up, you know, assumes that the governor wouldn't have manipulated the call, that the governor wouldn't have added some of these things to it if he wanted to. And I think that's pretty likely.
Of course, it's easy to now be like, oh, well, we wouldn't have done this if we had just had the TWEA and congressional redistricting in July, right?
Right.
Yeah, easy claim to make.
Yeah, it's completely non-credible.
Well, in the realm of education, though, most things would have been wrapped up by the end. I mean, the governor probably could have added school efficiency measures, I think, to a call, but it probably would have been less likely if the focus of a special session was on TWEA.
Although you can unwrap whatever you want in a special session,
right.
Theoretically.
Right.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, the idea that the special session was going to be about TWEA was really just the lever. Right, to get you there, and then once you're there, as we've seen with this one, he can add whatever he wants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, also with the 10 best, that I assume is mostly about the regular session, right? You know, there are some things that I think have happened in the special session that might bolster your claims for any of the people on the list, but and specifically, I'm turning over to Julian and the recent immigration debates, which have gotten particularly contentious. I mean, I had one lawmaker tell me that they have never felt so sad. It was a Democratic lawmaker, obviously by the comment, but they had never felt as sad when they left the Capitol as they did after the recent SB9 debate.
Yeah, during the you know the
you should say what SB9 is. That's what Ross would do.
Ross, where are you when we need you? He's in Disney World, is that where he is?
We can't say.
Oh, sorry.
Undisclosed location.
Undisclosed location, okay. Anyway, Ross, this one's for you. SB9, Tommy Williams, is a three-part bill. It was part of his original SB9 and part of HB12 in the regular session. Driver's license provisions are pretty much sets... makes these actual black and white rules, what DPS has been doing for a couple of years anyway, that anybody who is a legal resident must show proof of that before they get a driver's license, and their licenses expire when their legal status does, and they have to renew every year, and people are upset about it, and they say DPS clerks, not immigration officers. There are 24 different types of legal visas and things, so that's one part of it. The second part, it expands secure communities, which is a controversial issue anyway. There are four states across the country currently looking to opt out, so Texas is looking to expand it. And then obviously sanctuary cities, which is what I'm assuming the senator that spoke to you earlier today was talking about. You know, she felt so sad. And it was a very tense moment last night in the Senate chamber when people were discussing what they think the effects of this bill are going to be. You know, Senator Whitmire was the first to speak against it, and he spoke with Senator Williams, who authored the bill, and he said, "You have to know that you and I are never, ever, ever going to be pulled over for a busted taillight and asked for our papers." And then he asked all the Hispanic Democratic senators to stand up, and some of them looked like they were reluctant to do so, but eventually they did. And you could have heard a pin drop in that chamber. It was really, really intense. And Senator Vandepute, her voice was shaking because she was either so sad or so angry. Even Senator Ogden and Senator Dole said, reluctantly they voted for the bill. And they both experienced discrimination. Kind of, a lot of people were saying the same way Wayne Christian said he did.
Right. We should have a little interlude here to discuss the definition of discrimination, which seems to have become sort of a bizarre issue in the House and Senate. Right. Specifically, like you just referenced, Wayne Christian recently gave this, frankly, very strange, sort of inarticulate, nonsensical speech recently, in which he said, "Well, I had it here." He said. I'm one fellow that was racially discriminated against. See, back in the 70s, I was on the first team in basketball in my high school, my sophomore and junior years. We integrated my senior year, and I rode the bench because I couldn't play as good as they did because white boys couldn't jump. And it's like, that is not discrimination or racial discrimination. That is a skill-based
discrimination
metric. Yes,
skill-based discrimination.
Which is how people are just, But the claims they made in the Senate were I was discriminated against because I'm a Yankee, discriminated against because I have long hair.
Senator Ogden said that his daughter-in-law is Cuban-American, and she doesn't want to drive through Arizona. And he wasn't saying him personally, but he was saying, look, it affects everybody. And Cuban-Americans, they're a pretty conservative lob. They're very anti-Castro. And and as are a lot of Hispanics these days that are somewhat conservative and say, look, come here legally. Don't pigeonhole. This illegal immigration problem makes us all look bad. It makes everybody think that we're all illegal immigrants, and some of us came here legally. Some of us followed the rule book, and a lot of people say, well, my great grandfather came here legally. It was a lot easier. The argument is that it was a lot easier to do it in the 30s or the 40s or the 50s than it is now. There's a backlog and whatnot. And what Senator Dole was saying was that he moved from West Virginia to Texas, and he was discriminated against because he had long hair and he was driving a VW bus or whatnot. But yeah, I don't think.
What a hippie.
I know, right? You tell them that. I don't think either of them would say, though, that it equals Senator Hinojosa, a U.S. citizen, being deported when he was 6 years old, or Senator Uresti, who served in the military, who when he would take his gear off and he was all sweaty, he said yesterday, they would say, oh, look, there's a true wetback. I don't think that either of those two Republican lawmakers think that what they said is on par with what their Hispanic Democratic colleagues experienced. But going back to the Wendy Davis thing, at first, a lot of the Democrats were saying, well, this is going to open us up to sanctuary cities. And they changed their tune a little bit, and they rallied around her, and they said, well, he was going to do it anyway. So that's where we are right now. What happens in the House is, it's yet to be determined. Some of these lawmakers were out at this rally today saying, we're already, having a rules meeting. We're looking to kill this bill. We're looking to, amend this bill, and we're looking to see what happens. But everybody saw what happened in the House the first go around. So, it's pretty much likely to come out. The way it was amended last night, which was two amendments that didn't really do a lot to the bill, so it looks like this is going to pass. It's going to go to the governor's desk, and wait and see what happens. Are people going to be pulled over, for a busted taillight and get checked for papers, or law enforcement that are adamantly opposed, are they just going to say, look, I can do it if I want to, but I choose not to do it?
Well, this bill doesn't say you have. It doesn't tell people to do something, right? No. It tells people that they can't prevent law enforcement from checking immigration status. Yeah, like they pull someone over for a different reason.
Sure. That's what they're saying. It's, you know, it's the word discretion that the governor's been throwing around a lot. And the bill does give these officers discretion, but a lot of people are saying, you know, it's a double negative, which equals a positive. Just, you know, when you say you can't do something, it automatically makes people assume, well, you can't say that I can't, so I'm going to.
So how do you expect voters to react to this, Mr. Henson?
Well, he's shaking his head over here on the language of the bill, so let's get into
that. Well, he has a weak neck.
Well, I mean, what I'm shaking my head about, I mean, it's not disagreement. I think this is a very, well, to say the least, the history of the Sanctuary City Bill, or, you know, the anti-Sanctuary City Bill, which is really what it is,
sure,
is very odd. I mean, this goes back to, I mean, this is, you know, basically, you know, a solution in search of a problem. I mean, this goes back, the origin of this bill goes back to the campaign when the Perry campaign used this notion of Houston being a sanctuary city as a diversionary tactic to run the white campaign off the rails, even though it became apparent fairly quickly that Houston wasn't a sanctuary city in the sense that Berkeley is a sanctuary city, and that the policy on enforcement of federal immigration law, it being essentially optional, was about the same as DPS. So what you had in a lot of ways, in my view, was, you know, a fairly cynical ploy. I mean, this legislation, or the whole concept of an anti-sanctuary city bill, was really, you know, in the film term, kind of a MacGuffin. It was just a plot device to divert the attention of the audience towards a particular kind of immigration discussion that allowed Perry to sidestep the more sort of draconian Arizona legislation and the Arizona approach, still speak to the grassroots and to the, you know, strong anti-immigrant strain that's highly mobilized inside the Republican Party right now, but also give a wink and a nod to the business community that he really wasn't going to do anything, you know, particularly vexing to them, like the Obama administration has been, for example, by upping employee sanctions. So, I mean, what I'm shaking my head at is really the, you know, that we've wound up here with Williams being able to use this as a vehicle to put some more substantive and, I think, problematic provisions, sure, you know, in the bill.
Such as?
But it's, the ones that Julian was talking about, the database checks, the mm-hmm. tightening up of the provision of IDs, you know, which were really separate in the initial manifestation of all this legislation. So it's a, you know, it's a pretty odd sequence of events that I think is really driven more by politics than by policy.
And Senator Williams' defense, he did say, he's like, look, this is something nobody's talking about. We were able to get $63 million more for DPS clerks and for these stations to help facilitate this paperwork. But a lot of people are still having a lot of issues saying, look, it's hard enough right now to get a driver's license to convince somebody, hey, look, this is all I need. You're gonna make it even more difficult. Another thing that was interesting last night, there were certain amendments that were offered to exclude children and one specifically to exclude victims of crime, children, child victims of crime, including sex crimes, trafficking crimes. And he said, well, this could interfere with their ability to get a U or a T visa, which are federal visas that are granted to certain witnesses who agree to cooperate with law enforcement to help put these alleged criminals behind bars that engage in these activities. And what a lot of people are saying this morning is that those visas aren't just kind of handed out like, here you go, thanks for your cooperation, you know, welcome to the U.S. They're very, very difficult to obtain. They're capped, 5,000 each, nationwide every year. And there's such a backlog on processing these that, you know, I mean, if you're an illegal immigrant and you're a woman and you've been battered and beat on for 10 years and you finally have the courage to call somebody, is the second thing that she says after help me, by the way, where can I get a U visa or a T visa? It's really not on their radar. So these are a lot of questions that I think are going to come up when it hits the House floor.
Okay, and going back to where you were saying, Jim, sanctuary cities, you know, whether it's a legitimate issue or not in terms of if we have any in Texas, right? If you take that issue that seemed to work during a gubernatorial campaign and say somebody might want to try to apply it to a national campaign, would that be a successful tactic? This is purely hypothetical.
In a purely hypothetical setting, I think it's part of a package of a national campaign that speaks to, as I said, the grassroots on one hand and the highly mobilized. I mean, the situation nationally is, different numerically, but not in kind from the situation here. If you're running a national campaign, there's a real division vertically in the Republican Party between, I think, you know, for lack of a better term, elites or strategists in the Republican Party looking at demographics, worried about Hispanic votes, and business interests that have, you know, that rely on, you know, something resembling the status quo on immigration, and the grassroots who are culturally mobilized and in many places, you know, virulently anti-immigrant. I mean, I don't think there's any way you can call it something else. And that is part of, that is going to be part of the Republican campaign.
Is Perry
at
going
the presidential level?
Is Perry going to be able to?
Wait, we were talking about Perry. I thought we were just speaking, you know, hypothetically.
I was talking about Ron Paul.
Oh, okay.
Well, will Ron Paul or Perry be able to take the grassroots momentum that Michelle Bachmann has, who is already in the race, has really generated, and I mean, are those going to be the three that are competing for the hardcore Tea Party vote?
Does Michelle Bachmann, has she generated a lot of real grassroots momentum other than cable news with her inability to look in the camera?
Well, you know, I wouldn't underestimate the degree to which cable news is actually connected to the grassroots in the Republican Party. Perhaps not all of the cable stations, but one in particular is clearly very plugged into the grassroots of the Republican Party and the conservative grassroots.
I would imagine that Perry, as of those three, a candidate that appeals more to also the business-minded,
sure.
People can
right.
quickly jump in and they can be like, oh, well, we'll go with this guy because then we can like form an alliance.
Yeah, I mean, to answer Morgan's question, I mean, I think that, you know, with Bachmann in, Perry, you know, should Perry get in, you do have kind of a battle for, you know, the grassroots of the Republican Party between the two of them. And I think you're exactly right. Perry begins to trump, you know, trumps her, I think, in his ability to raise money and to divert some of that. You know, and I don't know what the outcome would be. I mean, you know, Perry is, you know, untested nationally.
Should he
get in?
Do we think Perry's running? Julian?
Well, he jogs. Is that what you mean? I don't think I'm qualified to say yes or no at this point.
Your colleague Emily Ramshaw said no last week.
That was last week.
That's before he went to New York.
That was before he went to New York, and that was before he had this. Well, I don't know if he was scheduled or not to speak in New Orleans, but it'll be interesting because he, you know, Texas does, like, and the governor's accurate. I mean, they have the state has created a lot of jobs even in the midst of this national recession. He has been speaking about border security for years, even before this whole speculation that he's going to get into the race began. You know, which puts, I guess, President Obama in a tight spot because, as our story said today, you know, under 3 years of Obama, he's referred more people for prosecution for illegal entry or reentry than Bush did in 8 years. But he can't campaign on that if he wants to court the Latino vote. It's a catch-22 for the president, so.
I mean, how can you say that he's not running? I mean, it just seems so clear to me that he is. And, I mean, for me, the question is, does he want vice president or does he want president?
But I mean, does anybody really say at the get-go, "I'm running for vice president"?
Right,
I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
I've never said that.
It's hard to see Rick Perry as vice president. I think.
Yeah.
It's not really who he is.
Right.
He was lieutenant governor.
And he stopped doing that after a while.
He did.
Yeah. So I mean, what is all this? You know, the faith-based organizations that are backing him. How does that play out for him? You know, we're talking about grassroots. You know. According that population, so is this good or bad for Perry that he's getting a lot of this buzz for being such a guy that, you know, true to his faith?
Good.
I mean, well, especially for the primary.
In a word, good. Yeah. I mean, I think.
And then once you get through the primary, it's sort of that doesn't matter. I mean, he's a Republican. He has the R next to his name. That's
right. I mean, it's certainly, at least in terms of the money. I mean, I agree with Morgan about the idea that I think it's kind of crazy to think he's not at some level already running. Now, he may decide not to get in at the end of the day, but he's running and has been running.
He was in, this past week, he was in California, New York, he's going to be in New Orleans.
Right.
The California Republican lawmakers are trying to draft him, so are the Arkansas Republican lawmakers. I mean, he's...
Well, and again, if you step back and look at the trajectory, you know, I mean, to me, the pieces are kind of going in place, and at any one of these points, things might have gone differently. So maybe the Gingrich campaign takes off. His guys wind up staying with Gingrich. Well, that reduces the probability. Well, as we know, that didn't happen, right? Maybe the session, you know, implodes and they lose control of the chamber, which is not was not impossible. Well, that didn't happen. He's pretty much gotten what he's wanted. So a series of things have happened. Maybe his name goes out there and the press is so intensely negative that the idea gets batted down and he's got to back off. None of these things have happened. As the trial balloons have gone up and things have developed, everything keeps saying go. I mean, I think the big piece that's waiting is the conclusion of the special session. You know, does he get these key things that he wants? Are they able to manage, you know, what is a very unruly legislature right now, I think. But if the special session ends, he gets most of the things he wants. What he's done, and you and I have talked about this, he's successfully rebranded Texas. What he's done, because what's implicit here is the need to slay that one big doubt that's out there both here and in all the coverage, which is America ready for another president for Texas? Mm-hmm. And what he needs to do is redefine what that means. And I think he's gone about that in a fairly effective way. He's repeatedly thrown Bush under the bus. And then he's gone on top of that and really pushed the legislature to do something that is a coherent package, you know, to take an approach that produces a coherent package that he can then go and campaign on nationally. It's basically a rebranding of Texas. It's no longer George Bush's Texas. Mm-hmm. It's now Rick Perry's Texas. And that's, you know, if you look at the speech yesterday in New York, look at Jay's coverage, Jason Embry's coverage. That's exactly what he's doing already.
Well, for a final word on that, let's go back to Representative Pena.
All right. Take it away, Aaron.
Hi, this is Representative Aaron Pena again, reminding you that any comments or questions about the TribCast can be emailed to podcast@texastribune.org.
Thank you, Representative. On behalf of Jim, Morgan, Julian, and our producer, Todd, this is Reeve Hamilton signing off. Thanks for listening. We're supposed to be having like a lighthearted, doing? Just banter at this point as we prepare to do the TribCast.
To warm ourselves up.
Yeah.
Okay.